Merry Christmas. 2 days before Christmas, Cedar Park Timberwolves. Congratulations. And just, it's so exciting to be together to worship God. And I'm always amazed, but again this morning, the quality of artistic expression that we have every week from the people who lead us in worship. I mean, Austin is a city that's known for great music, and we've got some of the best artists in our city that are part of our church that play on our worship team. And the breadth of our eclectic artists here, just incredible. Love that. And you see the fullness of artistic expression when the object of their art is something great. And so throughout history, those who have chosen artistic expression to capture and explain God have reached the zenith or the high point. And so we get to experience that week after week as we've got a great group of people that lead us into the presence of Jesus Christ. And Christmas is a great time for that expression. We want to welcome you at our Steiner campus who are coming to us, and also San Saba, welcome you guys as well, those who are joining by podcast. And for all of you, guests and visitors, family members from out of town, we're so glad that you're here today, and we're going to spend some time in the Bible today just looking at the family of Jesus. So if you got a Bible, turn to Matthew chapter 1. If you don't, we actually have them on the walls around the room. It's not improper or impolite to get up and go get one, especially if you're going to get the Bible in a Bible church. That's an okay thing. Feel free to do that. Some in the balcony and the back walls as well. Also, we have Wi-Fi capability here, so if you got an electronic device, you might consider going to BibleGateway.com and pulling up the passage on your electronic device so you can follow along, because real important to us, we work with the Bible here. We teach the Bible. We go through the Bible. So I want you to have access to that while we're teaching through it. Mount Everest, the highest point on the planet, has captured the imagination of humanity throughout history. At over 29,000 feet high, people have attempted to conquer and climb the summit of Mount Everest. Now, when I say people, I don't mean all people, because there are two issues with Mount Everest. One is it's really cold. That's why I don't live in Michigan anymore. I live in Texas. And it's really high, which means there's not a lot of air up there. So personally, the closest I've ever come to climbing Mount Everest was riding the Everest Expedition at Disney World with my son, Sherpa Sam, sitting beside me as we rode together. And we rode it over and over and over again, but I'm not going to Everest. But people have done that. In fact, since 1953, when Sir Edmund Hillary was the first to climb and make the summit, over 3,000 people have attempted and made that. And as great of a human feat as that is, humanity over nature, it also is very revealing, because there is a dark underbelly to the whole Everest experience. Take David Sharp, a 34-year-old engineer from Cleveland, who in 2006 decided that he was going to invest the $60,000+ that it cost to go on this expedition, and he climbed it. He made the summit. He was actually 948 feet south of the summit on his way back down when he ran out of oxygen. And there he sat down, exhausted and disoriented in the snow, while 40 other climbers walked by him without stopping to help. Can you imagine what that would be like? Sitting in the freezing cold, gasping for air, blinded by snow blindness, and hearing the sound of another human being coming up the trail, reaching out, knowing that if it wasn't somebody to help you, you would not survive. And then that voice and that noise faded away, disappeared, only to hear another and another. 40 people passing you on the way up, 40 people passing you on the way down to leave you there to freeze to death. Nobody willing to help. And I'm sure there were a lot of people that were thinking things like, well, I put 60 grand into this thing. Like, I don't know about this guy, but like, how could I ever go back and tell people that I didn't make it? It's my money. I've worked hard for this. I deserve it. It's for me. Or thinking, well, I don't know what this guy did to deserve getting himself into this. Maybe he wasn't properly prepared. It's probably his own fault anyway. Why should I stop and help? All kinds of reasons, but it doesn't change the reality that 219 people have died on the face of that mountain, frequently in the presence of others who could have helped them, but chose not to. Why? Because there is a sinister side to humanity. And so in the midst of the tragedies of this world, we tend to ask the question, where is God? Assuming that God is not present. Because if God is present, then the problems that we've created, that we've committed, would not somehow happen, right? We're going to address this on the 6th of January. I'm going to tackle the whole discussion theologically of the tragedy, like the one we're kind of grieving through and experiencing that took place in Newtown, Connecticut. So intentionally have not gotten into this discussion because it's the wrong time, folks. It's the wrong time for politicians and pundits to be talking about their positions. This is a time to grieve. Well, parents grieve, pundits pontificate. We're going to wait a little while. So on the 6th, I'm going to take this on. We're going to talk about it in church. In the meantime, let me just tell you that of all the things that Christmas says to you today is that God is not absent. God is involved. God is present. In fact, the whole concept of Advent, there's a coming. God is coming. Christmas is about the coming, that God is coming into our world. And God enters in to the messiness of our world, our lives personally, for the purpose of rescuing us. And that's what the story of Christmas is telling us. So when we look at the family of Jesus, starting in Genesis 1, as we kind of have been working our way through that, through the Advent season, we've come to understand that there are lots of messed up people even in Jesus' family line. In fact, we looked at Judah and Tamar. What a mess that thing was. For those of you who missed that message, go back and get it. The first message in this series, go listen to it. What a mess. And as you kind of work through these people, there were a few heroes that emerged, okay? So Rahab was a hero, Boaz and Ruth heroes, King David a hero, and yet we also found out last week that not only is David a hero, but he's a scoundrel. He's a lot like me and a lot like you. Heroic moments and moments of mass and utter self-destruction, stupidity. And then you keep working your way through the line. After David, king after king after king fails until we come to verse 11. It says, Josiah, the father of Jeconiah and his brothers at the time of the exile to Babylon. It got so bad that the promise in Deuteronomy that if you guys don't walk with me, God told them, I'm going to carry you off into exile. The chosen people, the people of the promise, get exiled into Babylon, carried away by a barbaric group of people because they just can't seem to get it together. We need help. And so God enters into this messy world. He enters into our messy lives to bring us back to himself, to rescue us. The final person in the genealogy here in verse 16, and Jacob, the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom was born Jesus, who was called the Christ. The last one in the line is Jesus, who's called the Christ, the anointed one, the Messiah, the sent one. Now, I want to spend us a little time looking at Jesus to understand that God is present with us. Now, this prophecy is made about Jesus. I want you to see a little bit more about him. In verse 21, it says, she will give birth to a son, and you are to give him the name Jesus, because he will save his people from their sins. The name Jesus is very significant. It's very important to get. The name Jesus is the Greek form of the Hebrew name Joshua, which means the Lord saves. Or when you think of the name Jesus, think of its meaning. It just means salvation. It just means salvation. And the fact that Jesus is going to be named this, that this child that's born is named Jesus, salvation, means that every time you think of Jesus, you think somebody needs to be saved. Someone needs to be rescued. Someone's in a desperate position, and they need to be rescued. That's why God sent Jesus into the world. Now, the text goes on to say that Jesus will save his people. In other words, Jesus is not simply saving at random. Jesus is actually saving a group of people that he will have a relationship with that will belong to him. In the immediate context, it's talking about the Jewish people. He came to save them, but we know from the rest of the New Testament that the Gentiles, the church, is also part of that. So Jesus is saving a group of people that will be his. He's uniting them as brothers and sisters, bringing them together, adopting them into God's family. And he says Jesus will save his people from what? From their sins. In other words, he's not saying that Jesus will save us from them or to save us from that. Now, most of the time, that's what we perceive, right? We perceive that the problems in our life, what we need to be rescued from, are other people. I mean, just think. Like, if all the idiots in this world would just leave you alone, just quit messing things up, from the government to your office to your neighborhood, even your athletic heroes. Like, if people, even in your family, like, Jesus, would you, my life would be wonderful. It wasn't for them. Jesus saved them, or saved me from them, or that. Circumstances. You know, Jesus, if you could just somehow redeem the amount of money that comes into my bank account, particularly at this time of the year, where it always had enough. You don't even have to add it up anymore. You just make sure that is fixed, that that keeps coming in. Or, you know, that I can break my diet for 2 months around Christmas time and I'll stay healthy. My sugar issues won't be a problem. My waist issues won't be a problem. If you could fix that, you just fix that. And the passage says Jesus didn't come to fix them or to fix that. Jesus came to save his people from us, from me, from ourselves. And we know that we need to be saved, don't we? Even the great theologian, Michael Jackson, sang some of the most true, profound words. I mean, it could have come right out of the book of Romans. He said, I'm starting with the man in the mirror. I'm asking him to change his ways. If you want to make the world a better place, take a look at yourself and make the change. In other words, if every human on the planet had a pure heart, pure motives, righteous actions, we wouldn't have any problems, would we? Things wouldn't be going the way they are, would they? Everybody recognizes that at the core, we need not systemic government changes, not changes in education, not changes in our diet. We need changes in our heart. And this passage is saying that God sent his son, Jesus Christ, to get involved with heart surgery, inner transformation, changing us from the inside out, saving us from that dark underside. And God has become present in order to do that. He's become present with us in order to do that. A number of years ago, in another mountain climbing, incredible mountain climbing feat, in 1957, four climbers decided that they were going to scale the north face of the Eiger Mountain. The north face is a 6,000-foot rock summit two Germans and two Italians decided that they were going to climb it. So they started to climb it. And as they got up, the four got separated. The two Germans disappeared. Nobody knows what happened to them, presumed dead. The two Italians made it about 1,000 feet from the summit. They got stuck on a rock ledge there. They couldn't go up. They couldn't go down. And they were just stranded there to die. When they got word out, the Swiss Alpine group said, it's too dangerous to go in there. Nobody can save them. Don't anybody try, and they forbid a rescue. But there were a group of Swiss mountain climbers who decided that they were going to try. And so they made their way up around the outside to the backside at the top of the summit, and they began to lower one of their comrades, one of their climbers, on a narrow little small cable down the north face, trying to get them down to and bring those two climbers back up. Now, the climber's name that they lower down describes that situation, but before I give you his description, I want you to see what they were actually dealing with. So here's the Eiger North Face. Let me put it up there for you. Yeah, right. People climb that stuff? Yes, interesting. That's what it looks like on a good day. Here's what it looked like on that day. Little different, huh? So, as Alfred Hellepart, the guy that's being lowered, is describing his experience, he says, as I was lowered down the summit, my comrades on top grew further and further distant until they disappeared from sight. At this moment, I felt an indescribable aloneness. Then for the first time, I peered down the abyss of the north face of the Eiger. The terror of the sight robbed me of breath. The brooding blackness of the face falling away in an almost endless expanse beneath me made me look with awful longing to the thin cable disappearing above me in the mist. I was a tiny human being, being dangled in space between heaven and hell. The sole relief from my terror was my mission to save the climbers below. Had it not been for a noble mission, Alfred said he would have gone mad just looking at his predicament. One little strand of cable, and 1,000 feet above and 5,000 feet below, being lowered down. In the same way, God sent someone to rescue us. And as Jesus Christ, suspended on earth between heaven and hell, as a little baby, enters into this world to experience everything that we've experienced, to grow up, knowing what it's like to be a child, knowing what it's like to be a teenager, knowing what it's like to be an adult, with all the temptations and frustrations. He wasn't born in a palace, didn't live in a really good situation. He was from a working class family. He lived out his adult life primarily traveling from place to place, sleeping on the ground, smelling his own sweat, tasting his own tears. Jesus Christ lived a life that included betrayal and friendship, that included the hardships of reality, going hungry and enjoying a blessed time with good things. He experienced everything that we experience and ultimately gave himself willingly as a sacrifice for our sin. God has sent a rescue party in the person of Jesus to get involved in our mess. He will save his people from their sins. The second name that we see about Jesus comes in verse 23. It says, the virgin will be with child and she will give birth to a son. They will call him Emmanuel, which means God with us. The Hebrew word there literally means the with us God. The with us God. In other words, God didn't send Jesus Christ to simply be near. God sent Jesus Christ to actually connect with us, to be part of us, to walk among us, to experience what we've experienced, and then to bring us into a relationship with God through himself. That's what God sent Jesus to do. Since this is a rescue mission, how do you receive a rescue? How do you receive a rescue? You actually have to reach out your hand to the one who's helping and let them take care of you. Let them lead you to safety. Let them provide the strength to move you forward. A lot of us don't want to do that. And so we fumble around with various things. Some of us are constantly trying to fake it. We're trying to pretend, like before God and other people, that we really have it all together. Only we live in the prison of trying to keep this wall up so nobody really knows what's going on in here. Because if they really knew, then they wouldn't like me. God wouldn't like me if he really knew, so I'm going to try to fake it. Some people try to fix it. Some of you guys are spending your life trying to self-improve, thinking that someday if you do enough good, you'll cover up all the bad. Some of you try to just fib it, like you just call ugly beautiful. You find things that you know are unjust and you justify them. You find things that you know are unloving and you make up excuses for them. You find things that you know are broken and you call them whole. And you're trying to fib your way through, trying to rewrite the code, so to speak, so you don't have to deal with it. And what God says, listen, is just reach out your hand and let me take you. Let me forgive you of your sin. Let me give you my righteousness. Let me bring you into a relationship with God. Let me take you and shape your life going forward to mold you into who I've called you to be. Let me give you an identity that's pure and meaningful. Just accept what I've come to do. I've come to rescue you and fix your messy life. That's what Jesus offers today. For those who have come to a place where you've received that, and I know many of you are still pondering that. Like, what does that look like for me? And how do I take that step? And where do I go? And by the way, today when we finish the service, we're going to have a chance for you to come talk to some people about how to move forward with that step. So if you're sitting there going, yeah, you know, this Christmas would be a really good time, I would say, yeah, it's a really good time. So we want you to take care of that today. Get some help with that. Move forward with that. For those who have already crossed that threshold, you say, you know, I have allowed Jesus to rescue me. He's forgiven me of my sins. He's moving me forward with him. What does life look like for me? Well, there's a second half to the story. I want you to see it. Starting in verse 18, it says, this is how the birth of Jesus Christ came about. So here's the facts of how it happened. This is how the birth of Jesus Christ came about. His mother Mary was pledged to be married to Joseph, but before they came together, she was found to be with child through the Holy Spirit. Because Joseph, her husband, was a righteous man and did not want to expose her to public disgrace, he had in mind to divorce her quietly. Now, there's a lot of kind of story that we've kind of, this is Christmas, so we kind of sanitize this, clean it up, make it look really good and kind of really holy, and everybody just got a halo. At least the books that we read to the kids, they all have a halo. Let's just talk about what's really going on here, okay? In the Jewish custom, a marriage was arranged. So mom and dad would get together and kind of work out who was going to marry each other. When the two were old enough to start the process of marriage, they would be formally engaged to one another. Formal engagement meant that they were totally committed to a future wedding, but for approximately a year, he would live with his family, she would live with her family, and during that period of a year, they would still live separately, but they were actually could only be separated by some kind of formal process where they would break that covenant. And then there would be a wedding feast at some point in time. They would come together. They would consummate the relationship. And before that, they lived in purity and they lived separate from each other. That's where they are. So Joseph gets the news Mary is pregnant. Now, I know when you're reading in the context of the Christmas story, that doesn't seem too weird. But dads, if your daughter came home and said, hey, Dad, I'm sorry to tell you I'm pregnant, it was the Holy Spirit. You're going to say, yeah, what's that boy's name? Where can I find him? You know, if you're an engaged man and she comes to you and she says, I'm pregnant, and you've lived in a pure relationship with her, you're going to go, who is it? the amount of betrayal you would feel is overwhelming, no matter what her explanation might be. So the text tells us in verse 19 that Joseph, her husband, was a righteous man. In other words, he's a guy who keeps the Old Testament law. He's a guy who does things correctly. So they have not had any relationships with each other prior to the wedding. They haven't done that. This is clearly not his doing. So now he's faced with two options. One of those options is to divorce her publicly. In other words, bring her out before the city officials and say, this woman that I was engaged to, she has betrayed me with another man. And because I'm righteous, I don't want anybody to think that I had anything to do with this, because it's not me. It was her. And publicly divorce her and humiliate her for what she's done. That was option one. Option number two is that he could do something quietly. In other words, he would divorce her, call the wedding off, but not make her appear as a harlot before the magistrates and talk about her. He would simply divorce her quietly, to which her family would probably ship her off to the cousins on the other side of the sea, and she'd have the baby there, and she'd come back, and all she'd be left with would be the rumors. But she wouldn't be disgraced. In both cases, he would prove to be righteous. Now, in our culture, being righteous is no longer a big deal, okay? Let's face it. We don't believe in being righteous anymore. We believe in fun. We believe in fulfillment. We believe in commitment that expresses itself in the moment. We do, okay? I mean, let's just be honest with each other. So being a righteous man in our culture is not considered worth much. So, you know, people do stupid things all the time. Doesn't matter how many people get hurt along the way, as long as I'm feeling good in the process, happy now, that's us, okay? So this wouldn't be a big story for us. Everybody'd be going, well, what's the deal? Joseph, you've messed up too. You never done anything wrong? Hey, get over it. You still love her? Go, you know, it's okay, no big deal. That's us. This wasn't the culture that Joseph was in. In the culture Joseph was in, keeping the Old Testament law, doing things right, followed you and your reputation your whole life. So Joseph now has a chance to get this behind him, not to mention the personal hurt, to get out of it in a way that it doesn't make him look bad. There's one more option. He's not considering that. In fact, in verse 20, it says, but after he'd considered this. Now, consider is probably a pretty weak word to translate what he's doing. You know, I can imagine walking the floor, throwing things, talking to his friends, why would she do this to me? How could, you know, what am I going to do? Everybody's going to think I'm, you know, all in all in all. After he considered this, an angel of the Lord appeared to him in a dream and said, Joseph, son of David, do not be afraid to take Mary home as your wife, because what is conceived in her is from the Holy Spirit. She will give birth to a son, and you are to give him the name Jesus, because he will save his people from their sins. All this took place to fulfill what the Lord had said through the prophet. Isaiah 7:14, the virgin will be with child and will give birth to a son. They will call him Emmanuel, which means God with us. He's saying, this is the promised anointed one, Messiah, the Christ. That's what the angel is telling him. And he's saying, you need to take Mary, because what she's told you is true. You need to take her and marry her. In other words, what he's saying here is that God is calling him to involve his righteous reputation in the societal mess that's going to come about for him marrying a woman who's already pregnant. And all of that mess, he's supposed to enter into that and participate in that, regardless of what it does to what he looks like or what he feels like. He's being called into a saving type responsibility. In other words, the principle is this, that God calls us as people, his followers, to enter into the messy lives of others to rescue them or to lift them up. God calls us to enter into the messy lives of others to rescue them or to lift them up. Watch what he does. When Joseph woke up, he did what the angel of the Lord had commanded him. He took Mary home as his wife, but he had no union with her. That's very interesting. Had no union with her until she gave birth to a son, and he gave him the name Jesus. There's a new kind of righteousness emerging here. Let me tell you what it is. You see, true righteousness in this passage is really expressed in the concept of entering in to lift people up. Entering in to lift people up. It's not keeping my reputation unsoiled. It's not standing apart or above those whose lives are messed up. It's not simply looking in and offering a word of condemnation. It's actually getting personally involved. Joseph is going to land smack dab in the middle of all of this confusion to be part of raising the Savior of the world. And we're called to do the same thing. Thursday, I'm finishing up my tutoring at Cypress Elementary School, where I'm a literacy partner. So I've been doing this for 3 years now. I started off at Nauman. First year, they gave me second graders, and then they demoted me to kindergarten, and then I left, went to another school so I could get back to second grade. So I'm back in second grade, and you know, we sit down with a couple kids every week, and we read to them, they read to us, and it's a literacy thing to kind of help them with their reading. And so after we finished reading, it was kind of a weird day anyway, because it was pajama day at the school. You ever feel like you're just out of place, like you're not dressed correctly? I didn't know it was pajama day. I don't know about you, but the majority of the people I talk to have had a recurring dream when they were a kid. You know that dream when you dream that you wake up and you're sitting in your seat in your second grade class and you have just your underwear on or your pajamas and you're kind of looking around. And anybody dream that dream? Like, I dreamed that dream when I was a kid. So anyway, I'm at school and I don't have my pajamas on, so I'm really out of place, feeling really awkward. Anyway, so I'm talking to the teacher who's wearing her pajamas, which was really a weird experience. And she says to me, she says, I want you to know that it means so much to these kids and to me and to our district that you would be willing to come and do this, to come and help these kids. And I said to her, I don't get that, because when I was in second grade, I couldn't read either. My form of mild dyslexia and a move from one school to another and some personal struggles, like I went into third grade and I couldn't read Dick C. Spot Run. I couldn't do that, and I really refused to try because I wasn't going to open my mouth and make a fool of myself in front of the other kids. So I would sit there and I wouldn't even try. I could not read. And so because the teacher and the help, she pulled me aside, worked with me in that class. By the time I finished the second grade, I was caught up. I could read. So I told the teacher, what I'm doing here is not noble. This isn't noble at all. What I'm doing here is normal. This is just normal. Like when somebody's done something for you, isn't it normal that you would do something for someone else? If someone's helped you, like wouldn't it be normal for you to help someone else? This is what kills me about the Church of Jesus Christ. How in the world have we gotten a reputation for being judgmental? Don't you know where you came from? Sinners? I do? Sinner? Why would I ever look down on someone else's sinning? Why would I ever do that? If it wasn't for Jesus rescuing me, I would be on the path to hell traveling at such a high rate of speed. I mean, I would. So why wouldn't I want to help someone else? Why wouldn't I want to get my hands dirty helping someone else, working with someone else, reaching out to someone else? You see, there's a new definition of righteousness. It's not how clean can I keep myself, how much dirt can I keep off of me, how many people can I look down on in the process. True righteousness is the willingness to enter in, like God's calling Joseph to do here, in order to make a difference. Let me give you another thought as we wrap up today. That thought is this: all life-changing love is a substitutional sacrifice. All life-changing love is a substitutional sacrifice. Tim Keller, in his best-selling book, The Reason for God, states this concept this way. He says, imagine you come into contact with a man who is innocent, but who is being hunted down by secret agents or by government or some other powerful group. He reaches out to you for help. If you don't help him, he will probably die. But if you ally with him, you, who are perfectly safe and secure, will be in mortal danger. Like, this is the stuff that TV and movie plots are made of. Again, it's him or you. He will experience increased safety and security through your involvement, but only because you are willing to enter into his insecurity and vulnerability. Make sense? In other words, you have to sacrifice something, your security, by giving some of that to him to create more security. And you're taking on, in a sacrificial way, some of his insecurity, some of the danger, some of the weakness. You're taking that on yourself. That's how it works. But if you want to change someone's life, you've got to be willing to take your strength and give it to someone, and in turn receive or take on some of their weakness, some of their liabilities. So the question that Keller raises is it possible for God to change us if he's not willing to shoulder or take on some of our weakness to give us his strength? And the answer is no. That's why Jesus Christ came in human flesh. The incarnation is all about God taking on our weakness and coming to be among us so that he could save us, give us his righteousness. And then he calls us to do the same thing. To do the same thing. You see, the reason why Christmas is so unique is because Christianity is so unique. Because there is no other religion in the world that actually teaches that God was dangled between heaven and hell on a place called earth to come and be among us and to actually provide salvation for us. This Christmas, you need to understand, God has come. He has saved. You need to receive. And once you received, you need to pass on that salvation to others, even if you get dirty in the process. That's what Christmas is all about. That's the hope of Christmas. Let's bow our heads for prayer. Father in heaven, we just want to tell you that this story, this truth, this reality is overwhelming. It's amazing. Pardon us if we sit with our jaw dropped, trying to take it all in. It's mind-blowing that you would send your son into our world to bear our sins for our good. Father, may there be no person, no heart, no mind that leaves today without a full understanding and assurance that they place their full confidence and trust in the saving work of Jesus Christ, with a heart to share.